For over half a century, London W12 7RJ Wood Lane became the spiritual home of British television. Designed by the architect Graham Dawbarn, this was the UK's first purpose-built TV hub with the cutting-edge camera technology, 8 bespoke studios, production galleries, and the now legendary BBC bar. Well, for many, BBC Television Centre came to represent the magic and glamour of British entertainment, light entertainment, glossy, glamorous shows, and hosted everything from Auntie's New Bloomers to Z Cars behind those famous double doors. To mark 10 years since the closure of Britain's most famous television studios, Beyond the Title welcomes some of the BBC's best-loved faces to remember and celebrate the history and legacy of TV's first dream factory. So, join Josh and the team as they remember BBC Television Centre.
Writer, actor and broadcaster Mark Curry found fame in 1976 when he appeared as Oscar in Alan Parker's cult classic Bugsy Malone. In 1981, he co-hosted the series Get Set for Summer on BBC One with main host Peter Powell and Lucy Skeeping before moving to Manchester to preside over Saturday morning children's programmes for the BBC. But in 1986, he returned to London to join the BBC's flagship children's entertainment series Blue Peter alongside Peter Duncan, Janet Ellis and the late Karen Keating. After Blue Peter, Curry stood in for the legendary Roy Castle on the iconic children's show Record Breakers, before joining the Radio 5 commentary team for their coverage of Wimbledon in the early 90s. I caught up with one of the most versatile TV stars the corporation has seen as part of Beyond the Title's TV Centre season to celebrate the magic of Britain's finest dream factory. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mark Curry.
So, welcome to this podcast and a special series celebrating the magic of TV Centre. By way of an introduction, what were your first memories of TV Centre and how did it ignite your passion for live TV?
Wow, first memories of Television Centre. Well, I didn't do anything there until the early 80s because my presenting and television work had all been up north. First of all, at Yorkshire Television and then at BBC Manchester. So what brought me down to Television Centre was when they would have every year a kind of get-together of all the presenters, particularly the kids presenters. So I was invited down to this exhibition. It was a press day and the Blue Peter team were there. I wasn't doing Blue Peter then. I was doing a Saturday morning live TV show from BBC Manchester. And I remember, being driven in. I got the train down from Leeds to King's Cross and then a car picked me up and whisked me to Television Centre. So this would be around about 1982, something like that, 82, 83. And the commissioner lets you in and the gates opened and we drove up what's called the Horseshoe and walked into this building and it was like, wow, this is London, this is the BBC and that iconic building and just being very, very excited, but also feeling slightly out of it because I wasn't doing my programmes from London. I was doing BBC Manchester. But then Record Breakers, presented by Roy Castle, decided they did a thing called All-Star Record Breakers every year, which was a summer special. And they invited all the presenters on kids' telly to do this big summer show. And we often used the studios at Television Centre. So that was the first time. That would be about 84. And I was invited to be on one of the shows. And I sang a song with Tony Hart, the great legendary Tony Hart. I can see Josh shaking his head there. So obviously he remembers him. And I sang Matchstick Men and Matchstick. What is it? Matchstick Men and Matchstick Cats and Dogs, a song about Larry. And while I sang it really quite badly, Tony Hart did all the drawings. But I was actually in one of the big studios at Television Centre, and that was just amazing, absolutely amazing. So early memories, those are the early memories.
Wobbly sets, cheap props and budget special effects are all things that we associate with TV studio-based drama. But as an actor, what are the main differences between a TV studio and filming on location?
Ooh, that's a good one. Well, it's controlled, obviously, when you're in the studio. I think it's probably more exciting because you've got that whole thing of being actually in the studio. So you go to makeup, you've got a costume, you've got a dressing room, and you walk into a studio with a set. And the sets are fantastic. I've only done a little bit of television drama, but the sets have been great when they've been studio based. Whereas on location, when I did Hollyoaks and when I did Doctors, we were actually shooting in Hollyoaks. You shoot in Liverpool on their sets, which are wonderful, but you're sometimes outside on location. And with Doctors, I was shooting. It was actually at Pebble Mill Studios. The interiors for Doctors were filmed there, and then we used somebody's house, a beautiful house in Edgbaston. So it's different. It, in a way, it's more realistic when you're on location in a house. But there's something for me as a performer about being in a studio with cameras and lights and the crew and makeup and costume. For me, that's a little bit more showbiz, really. Mm. And when you're presenting, obviously, my presenting work in a live studio, it was just the most exciting thing. Just absolutely fantastic. You're on the set and you've got the cameras looking at you and they're moving around and, yeah. Wonderful. So I think the excitement is probably more in studios for me, anyway.
Right. In 1986, you were unveiled as part of the lineup for the new look Blue Peter alongside Peter Duncan, Janet Ellis, and the late, great Karen Keating. In what way did you feel a pressing responsibility to replicate the magic of the trio of Singleton, Purves, and Noakes?
I did feel the pressure, but I was lucky in that I got a lot of experience on television already by the time they asked me to do it. So I didn't have to audition for the show. Simon Groom had been there for 8 years and they wanted the producers, the head of children's television at the BBC, Edward Barnes, they wanted somebody who was known to step in, somebody that the kids knew. So that was good for me. I think had I been a brand new presenter, well, I probably wouldn't have passed the audition actually. Because the audition for Blue Peter was really, really tricky. You had to make a Christmas card. You had to learn some script. You had to jump on a trampoline. You had to do all these different things. Because I've sat in on a couple of those auditions, but I didn't have to do it. So I was lucky that I was asked to do it. So, I did feel the pressure. I knew it was a big show. And I knew that you were stepping into shoes that everybody knew. You know, the great John Noakes, Val, Peter, and, of course, Simon. You know, Simon had been there for 8 years. But I didn't feel the pressure as much as I would have done had I not been experienced. For me, it was just another live show, a bigger show, but another live show. It was everybody around me who was saying, you're doing Blue Peter. You've got Blue Peter. They've asked you to do Blue Peter. They were almost more excited than me. They made me realize just what a big deal it was, because we're talking about the 80s when we were getting 6 and 7 million viewers sometimes for a kid's show, which is totally unheard of now. It's almost unheard of for peak time shows. So it was everybody else saying, you can't hang around making a decision. You've just got to do it. So they made me realize. And then, of course, as the show goes on and you're part of it, then you realize when doors open and everybody wants you to be there and you know, the kind of fame that went with that. So, It was nerve wracking, but not. I didn't feel the pressure too much. I just felt the pressure for the live shows because it was live, twice a week then, and at 5 o'clock the script would change, and you had to do it all 5 minutes later. You know, so that was always nerve wracking, but exciting more than nerve wracking, really.
Yeah. In your opinion, how integral was the legendary Billy Baxter to the durability and sustainability of Blue Peter? What's her legacy on the longevity of the show?
She was the driving force behind the show. Absolutely, when I was there. She left during my time there. I'd heard about her. I'd met her. I'd heard she was quite formidable, very much in charge. But right from the start, I got on with her really well, really well. Again, probably because I was experienced. And I just realized that she knew the program. She was the one person who knew how that program worked. She lived, breathed, ate and slept the show more than we did, the presenters. Sometimes we wanted a night off or we wanted to not talk to her for a day. And she'd be ringing up saying, darling, it's really exciting. On Thursday, we've got this, this, this. And I'd go, okay, Biddy, well, can we talk about it tomorrow? No, we've got to talk about it now. You know, it was her life and therefore it had to become your life. But that's the kind of leader you want on a show like that, because it was nonstop. It was practically all year, all those programs, all that filming, all those ideas. She supported me totally. Any little problems that I had, she was always there for me. If anything happened on the show, like if a guest didn't turn up or suddenly an item had to change, she had plan B, plan C, plan D. And she'd be in your ear saying, okay, don't worry about that. Mention this, mention this. You know, a totally professional, committed boss. And I'm not sure they make them like that anymore. You know, after the show, she'd sometimes call you up and she'd say, I need you to come in and I need you just to watch something that, that you're doing, which isn't really a good idea. And you'd sit there and you'd learn. You'd learn from her. Mm. And sometimes I see presenters now and I think they need a little session with somebody like Biddy Baxter just to kind of help them and you know, how to deliver things and how to present, really, you know. And she knew the show. So, yeah, she was the absolute driving force. And Lewis Bronze came after her and he was terrific. And he sort of continued the Biddy Baxter legacy, but maybe in a bit more of a relaxed way, really. But I really admired it. I thought she was wonderful, wonderful.
Looking at your career, it's easy to draw parallels with Purves and Duncan in that you're all trained actors. How did your experience as an actor help you to perfect the balance between broadcaster and entertainer on a show like Blue Peter?
Well, I really wanted to do more entertaining on Blue Peter. I was the one who said, when it was Christmas time, I'd say, let's do musical numbers. I drove everybody mad, saying, come on, this is a chance to dress up and do these things. We did an item called Around the World in 8 Minutes. And Karen Keaton was saying to me, do I have to really get into Brazilian costume? And I said, yeah, you do. And you have to get the false eyelashes on and all, because I just loved all that. And Yvette Fielding loved that as well. Peter Duncan loved that. Janet enjoyed it to a lesser extent. But once we got the costumes on and we got the choreography going and the lighting and sound and set, we all loved it. And any chance to perform on the show, I obviously relished. But when I was presenting, I was always aware that you're not acting when you're presenting, you are being you. You're not performing. And I think that's something that presenters always have to remember. If you want to be a presenter, you're not performing being a presenter, you're being you and being realistic. So I was quite careful to hopefully not perform too much when I was actually presenting. I wanted to be me, but I was always aware that it was a live show. So in a way you are performing, if that makes sense. But any chance to do anything, any historical pieces or whatever, I just absolutely, absolutely relished it, you know.
Yeah. After Blue Peter, you were selected to be the replacement for the legendary Royal Castle on the iconic children's series Record Breakers. In what ways did the vast landscape of TV Centre allow the opportunity to create entertainment on a larger scale?
Oh, massively. I didn't really replace Roy, by the way. He was very ill, so I was asked to step in because they needed somebody to help and they needed somebody experienced. So I really joined Chris Agabusi and Cheryl. Roy was there, but he was doing less and less because he wasn't well. Great guy, just a wonderful man. I remember that Cheryl and I broke the record for the biggest total of Irish dancers in one place. So we had to learn a whole sequence of Riverdance. When I meet Cheryl, we talk about it. It was unbelievable to learn. We went to see the show and then they said, you've got to do a bit of that. We said, what? You're joking. And we had to practice at home. We had to, I was jumping about the house doing all this. And the neighbours who were friends came round and she went, Mark, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what are you doing? All we can hear is you running up and down and banging your feet on the ground. I said, well, I'm doing Riverdance. She said, you're doing Riverdance? What, can you do it quieter, please? So I wrapped all this padding around my feet and wore about 4 pairs of socks so I could jump about and do those steps. And there we were in the big studio at Television Centre. I think it was TC1 or TC3, I can't remember. And these dancers started off, I don't know how many there were, but there were hundreds of them. including the cast of Riverdance. They started off outside Television Centre and then they all came in to the studio. And Cheryl and I were part of that and we did it. And that's the kind of thing you could do in those massive studios. And we've all seen Blue Peter when the scene dock doors open and in comes, you know, five double-decker buses or 75 people on bikes, you know, or the Chalk Farm Salvation Army band would come in on the Christmas Eve show. You could do those kind of things in those massive studios. It was just this open space and you could do anything. It was just wonderful. I mean, sometimes on Blue Peter, our tiny set would just kind of fit into a corner of one of the big studios. And it was only when they had the big items that it would use the space. But yeah, phenomenal, phenomenal studios. Amazing.
Joshua, can you still river dance now?
I can still do a tiny bit of it. I can. I'm not doing a lot, but I can still do a little bit of it.
So you're currently appearing in Wicked at the Apollo Theatre, Victoria. What can you tell us about that?
Wicked, well, have you seen it? Seen it, Josh?
No.
Oh, you've got to see it. You have to see it. We need to sort that out. Well, it's a phenomenon, truly phenomenon. It's at the Apollo Victoria, 2,000-seater theatre, packed every single show. Celebrating 17 years in the West End next year, 20 years on Broadway. And maybe people think that it is The Wizard of Oz. It isn't The Wizard of Oz. There are bits of The Wizard of Oz in there. If you see the show, you kind of recognise certain moments of it. But it's basically the story of how this young girl who's born green and she's different and she's got these powers that she can't really control herself and she wants to right all the wrongs in the world, how she becomes the Wicked Witch of the West, what leads her to become this embodiment of evil. And is she really wicked? And also is the good witch, who we know from Wizard of Oz, Glinda, is she really good? What is good? What is wicked? And it's the story of their friendship, really. They meet at sorcery school or sorcery university. They hate each other. They sing a song called Loathing. They hate each other because Elphaba's green and nobody can stand to be near her. You know, they find her a bit weird. She doesn't fit in. And then, of course, Glinda and Elphaba become the best of mates and heroines. So it's not this conventional love story that you always get in musicals. It's a story of two women becoming heroines and sheroes, really. The music's fantastic. It's an 18-piece orchestra. It's 35 people on stage. The costumes are all handmade. Every single person in the show has handmade costumes. Even the shoes are made for every new cast. It's unbelievable. So when you've paid for the ticket, you sit there and you think, that's where my money's gone, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just this story of inclusion and diversity and magic, really. And it's very moving. It's funny. It's great music. So I totally get why it's still a phenomenon. And when we're on stage at the end, that's the only time we get to see the audience because we can't look at the audience during the show. And to see these people standing up night after night and on the matinees, it really touches people. So it's incredible.
Mm. Right. On Friday, the 22nd of March, 2013, BBC Television Centre closed its doors for the final time. What was your reaction to this?
Obviously, sadness. I'm a great traditionalist. I don't like it when things change, really, unless they really have to change because things aren't good. I sort of understood it, but I always think back. You know, I've been around a long time, and I always think back. And obviously, I was thinking back about my memories there and all the terrific talent that's worked there over the years. And I thought, does it really have to close? And I wasn't sure really why it had to close. But what's good is, and I'm sure other people have said this, it's good that it's still being used. I've done a couple of things there. And so it's still great to walk in, but it's not the same because you're not walking into the BBC studios as they were. There was nothing like arriving and walking. You'd get your dressing room key And on the way to your dressing room, you'd pass all the other dressing rooms and you'd look at the names on the dressing room doors. And it was just a who's who of television and theatre. Mm. And next door, there'd be Top of the Pops being done, or there'd be Tomorrow's World, or there'd be all these dramas and specials. And you were part of it. It was absolutely incredible. So I'm not sure that it will ever be the same again. But at least they've retained the building. That's the great thing. You can drive past it, you can walk past it, and you can look and you can see. And I just hope that young performers and young people are told about that building and about what went on in that building, because it was truly, truly remarkable, amazing.
Looking at broadcasting as a whole, how significant is TV Centre in the story of British popular culture?
Oh, it's enormous, enormous, because it was there from the beginning when television was starting. It was there, you know, during the 60s and 70s, which was the real boom in television. That building was there. And now whenever they do any documentaries about television or about pop or about singers or actors, there's nearly always a shot of White City Television Centre, the BBC, and you see it. So that's just how important it is. It was absolutely enormous. It will never be forgotten. Worldwide famous. You know, it was instrumental, really.
Yeah. The last question I asked everybody, what is the legacy of the TV Centre?
The legacy of Television Centre. Creation, production, ideas, innovation, really. Just the home of the BBC television, and everybody being able to see programmes, even if you were up in Yorkshire or Scotland or whatever, you were watching live shows, recorded shows, iconic programmes, all coming from that area in White City, Shepherd's Bush. And hopefully that building's there forever. Mm.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. That's a full question. Josh said, what a great way to end. Thank you.
Oh, cheers, Josh. It's hard to come up with those things, but yeah, brilliant. Brilliant idea to talk about it. You see, it's great that you're doing this and that people can remember, because we're also, it's changed now, hasn't it? Television's completely changed, and it's very easy to forget the past. So it's terrific that you're doing this, I think. Yeah, I'm sure everybody else said the same thing.
Yeah, thanks very much for your time. We really appreciate you taking the time out to do the interview.
It's a pleasure.